acknowledging that. And I understand that as a state court trial judge who has tried murder cases, I understand that the pain of victims, I understand the desire of colleagues to get revenge. However, justice is never about revenge. We do not allow victims or the friends or partners of the murdered to decide what justice is. Justice is doing right, not getting revenge. And we need to understand the difference between the two.
Judge Wendell Griffin, there's so much more to talk about. Judge Griffin wrote the essay, Finding Justice for Both Maureen Faulkner and Mumia Abu-Jamal, referring to the widow of the slain Philadelphia police officer, Daniel Faulkner. We will link to your piece, and we will also do a part two conversation with you. As you come to the end of your judicial career, you'll be retiring at the end of December after 24 years on the bench. You are also the pastor of the New Millennium Church and author of The Fierce Urgency of Prophetic Hope. In part two of our conversation, we're going to talk about your illustrious career on the bench. People should check it out at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berti, Neguzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Meredith Tanasarina. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KVOO Community Radio, and we're in the middle of our end-of-year drive. Help us meet our $70,000 fundraising goal by going to kvoo.fm/give to make a contribution today. KVOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kvoo.fm/give. You can also text KVOO by entering 44321 and text the word KVOO. Our members continue to support community radio every time they give.
KVOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KVOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kvoo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KVOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kvoo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KVOO Portland, time for your 5 o'clock news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KVOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive edition of the KVOO Evening News, Oregon Governor Kate Brown reduces the sentences of 17 on death row.
A new gun control law in Oregon is still held up in state court.
And in international news, coronavirus in China has become untractable.
Good evening. This is the KVOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 14th, 2022. KVOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we would like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Josh Salem. Outgoing Governor Kate Brown wants to end capital punishment in Oregon. In her last few weeks in office, she is commuting or reducing the sentences of all 17 prisoners on death row. Brown will also dismantle the state execution chamber in an effort to practically end capital punishment here. She specifically commuted the sentences of 17 individuals on death row to life in prison without the possibility of parole, effective today. Brown said, quote, "Justice is not advanced by taking a life, and the state should not be in the business of executing people. even if a terrible crime placed them in prison, end quote. Brown has used her power of clemency more than any previous Oregon governor. In the past, she has cited personal growth as part of the reason for reducing sentences. This time, the governor said the decision is solely based on her belief that the death penalty is immoral, as well as a waste of taxpayer dollars. She said it does not make communities any safer. Bobbin Singh of the Oregon Justice Resource Center said, quote, Oregon enters a new era today where the values that make our state better come to the forefront, and we leave behind the death penalty of a cruel past, end quote.
It's worth noting that the death penalty has come under fire in Oregon before. Then-Governor John Kitzhaber stopped enforcing it in 2011, and Brown continued that practice. In 2019, state legislators redefined the crime of aggravated murder, the only offense that's punishable by death in Oregon. They also narrowed the scope of what constituted a capital offense. Now it only applies to murders of children younger than 14, killing law enforcement officers, terrorist attacks that killed at least two people, and prison killings carried out by someone who had already been convicted of murder. In 2020, the Oregon Department of Corrections dissolved death row, moving inmates to general populations and other housing units in six maximum security prisons. Governor-elect Tina Kotek is also opposed to the death penalty due to her religious beliefs. Kotek appears aligned with Brown's views on the death penalty, but a future governor could reverse the removal of the execution chamber. Brown also commuted the sentences of 963 incarcerated adults during the coronavirus pandemic. That was to prevent the spread of disease. They were deemed medically vulnerable, were close to their release dates, or did not appear to create an unacceptable public safety risk in the governor's estimation. Oregon has executed two death row inmates in the past 50 years. The last person was Harry Moore in 1997. Capital punishment does remain a part of the state constitution and cannot be removed without a public vote.
Oregon's gun control measure, number 114, will still be put on hold by a Harney County judge. Judge Robert Ratio heard arguments on Tuesday about whether the measure should be put on hold while a legal challenge makes its way through the courts. At least one part of the gun control measure will be on hold, the requirement for new gun buyers to get a permit. Judge Ratio ruled that part of the law won't go into effect until the state has established a permitting system. He stated, quote, I'm going to continue the temporary restraining order with regards to the permit to purchase because I am convinced that there's irreparable harm to the constitutional right to bear arms under Article 1, Section 27, if I do not, end quote. The order will remain in place until he gets notice from the state that the permitting system is up and running. The new permits require a federal background check and a safety class. Ratio didn't rule on another aspect of Measure 114, the part that bans selling magazines that carry more than 10 rounds of ammunition. A decision from Ratio is expected by 5 p.m. Friday.
The number of evictions in Multnomah County has risen dramatically now that pandemic-related tenant protections are gone. In October, Multnomah County Circuit Court recorded 820 eviction cases, 92% of which were for non-payment of rent. Also in October, Oregon's Safe Harbor Law ended. That law stopped the eviction of tenants who have applied for rent assistance. It ran out of funding in August. Mo Farode is the owner of Stark Furs Management, which manages 2,000 units in East County. Farode said that nearly a quarter of his tenants were behind on rent. His company has filed the second most eviction cases in the county this year. Court records underestimate the total number of people displaced for non-payment of rent, since some tenants pack up and leave after receiving the required termination of tenancy warning from their landlords.
President Biden signs the Respect for Marriage Act. Lawmakers look for a way to fund the federal government. And Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene calls her comments about leading an armed insurrection sarcasm. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Today's a good day. A day America takes a vital step toward equality.
Thousands of people gathered on the South Lawn of the White House Tuesday to watch President Joe Biden sign the Respect for Marriage Act, which mandates federal recognition for same-sex and interracial marriages. The event was the culmination of a decades-long fight for marriage equality and was achieved with strong bipartisan support. Meanwhile, the House Appropriations Committee has introduced legislation to fund the federal government until at least December 23rd.
With the many challenges facing our nation and the world, including devastating natural disasters and the high cost of living, we cannot wait any longer to pass this bill.
Representative Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut says the short-term measure will allow federal agencies to continue operating. While lawmakers are close to a final agreement, she says they need more time. Inflation in the U.S. slowed again last month for the fifth straight monthly decline, though grocery prices increased 0.5% from October to November. Representative Maxine Waters of California says housing has become the primary driver of inflation.
There's no metropolitan area in the country where families can afford a home making minimum wage.
U.S. rental prices have hit record highs, up more than 12% from a year ago. Meanwhile, the country's biggest apartment companies saw their profit margins increase nearly $300 billion in the past year. The House committee investigating the January 6th attack will hold its final event on Monday, when committee chairman Benny Thompson of Mississippi says it will publicly release its list of criminal referrals.
The select committee has developed a massive body of evidence, thanks to the many hundreds of witnesses who have voluntarily provided information relevant to our investigation.
The committee's final report is expected before the end of the year, as Republicans are expected to dissolve the committee when they take control of the House in the next Congress. Meanwhile, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia says her recent remarks about the January 6th attack on the Capitol were sarcasm.
They say that whole thing was planned, and I'm like, are you kidding me? A bunch of conservative Second Amendment supporters went in the Capitol without guns, and they think that we organized that? I don't think so.
Green told attendees of a New York Young Republicans event she and former aide to President Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, would have won and they would have been armed. The White House condemned the remarks, calling them a slap in the face to law enforcement. Finally, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis leads former President Trump in a new USA Today Suffolk University poll. 56% of Republican and Republican-leaning voters prefer DeSantis, while only 33% would support Trump. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The National Labor Relations Board is struggling with being underfunded just as a historic unionization wave sweeps the nation. Union advocates are asking Congress to fully fund the agency before its lame duck session ends. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Labor unions are calling on Congress to fully fund the National Labor Relations Board before its lame duck session ends. The NLRB has seen its highest caseload increase in decades, but its budget has stayed flat since 2014. When adjusted for inflation and increased cost, that means the agency has actually seen a 25% dip in its budget. Jesse Mason was fired in April from a Seattle Verizon store while employees there were forming a union. His NLRB case won't be in court until February. Mason says that means 10 months when he's not talking to his coworkers, who may be left thinking promoting a union can lead to someone's firing.
Things would be so different if the NLRB had the resources to get me back there so much quicker with my back pay so that I can tell people, hey, here's how they broke the law. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we form a union.
Mason says the slowdown at the NLRB because of a lack of funds works in favor of companies, which are hoping to wait out this historic unionization wave. Union advocates are calling for Congress to include nearly $370 million for the NLRB in its upcoming budget. Sarah Steffens with the Communication Workers of America says in addition to responding to election petitions for people forming unions, the agency has to address alleged employer misbehavior.
Really, there is only one place, the National Labor Relations Board, that protects workers in these situations. So if they are underfunded, it's like tying the government's hand behind its back when it comes to enforcing labor laws.
Mason says it's difficult to overstate how important the NLRB is, especially at balancing the scales for workers and protecting their rights, especially now.
We're in an age where we're not just fighting local battles against a mom-and-pop store where they employ 10 or 20 people and we need a union there. These are massive companies, billion-dollar companies.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
It's been a couple of weeks since Congress approved a new contract for U.S. rail workers. Union members say they're no longer threatening to strike, but they're still holding demonstrations to amplify their concerns about working conditions. Mike Moen has the details.
The nation's railroad workers say while they have a new contract, they're still fighting for quality of life issues. That was demonstrated at informational gatherings held in Minnesota and other states yesterday. The regional solidarity rallies in Minneapolis and Duluth surfaced after Congress approved a labor deal for the rail industry, averting a strike. The agreement was criticized by workers for not including paid sick leave. Nick Kadich, the Minnesota legislative director for the largest freight railroad union, says workers aren't threatening to walk off the job right now, but they want people to know that working conditions are draining morale.
Our folks are just tired. They're fatigued. They can't go on like this. We can't recruit new employees.
The union is calling on President Joe Biden to take executive action to address paid leave. Beyond that, labor leaders say worker safety is another big concern as rail companies opt for smaller crews to create efficiencies. The Association of American Railroads says it hopes to address these concerns, but adds the new deal should help with scheduling issues and deliver pay raises. On the safety issue, Kadich says trains are operating with more cars, making them more susceptible to mechanical failure. He says that creates hazards when some trains operate with just one crew member.
There's kind of a task overload as crew size has been reduced and more technologies have been added.
To enhance safety, the Federal Railroad Administration has proposed a rule to require a minimum of 2 train crew members for over-the-road rail operations, with some exceptions. That process is now in the public comment phase.
Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KABU Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KABU membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Street Roots editor Chief Kay Rambo on a new article covering the benefits of tenant protections and where they've stalled in Portland. Stick around at 8 for Ditch Digger. Tonight's weather will be chilly and breezy with an overnight low of 33. Tomorrow, more sunshine and a high of 44. Today in history, Thomas Goldsmith Jr. and Essel Ray Mann are granted a patent for their cathode ray tube amusement device, which was the earliest known interactive electronic game, hence our music. The quote of the day is from Wilma Mankiller, who on this day in 1985 was the first woman elected to serve as principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. She said, quote, "Cows run away from the storm while the buffalo charges towards it and gets through it quicker. Whenever I'm confronted with a tough challenge, I do not prolong the torment. I become the buffalo."
COVID is surging in China, and health authorities have admitted the growth of the disease has become impossible to track. They no longer record asymptomatic cases in their daily tallies. Last week, China's government ended the long-running strict zero-COVID policy, rolling back measures like travel restrictions and lockdowns. Health authorities also ended mass testing drives and compulsory regular testing, which were also key parts of the policy. The government has urged people not to seek emergency health care unless necessary and announced the rollout of second boosters to elderly and vulnerable people. Official state media outlet The China Daily reported Beijing had seen a more than six-fold increase in admittance to Beijing hospitals in the last week and 16 times more patients at fever clinics.
Well, it's that time of year when holiday shoppers need to be on the lookout for financial scams, especially on social media. Suzanne Potter has more on how to avoid the latest holiday scams.
With the holiday shopping season in full swing, scammers are hard at work. So the experts have some tips on how to shop smarter. The most common types of scams these days are online shopping scams, empty gift cards, and package delivery scams, according to AARP Fraud Watch. Kathy Stokes, Director of Fraud Prevention Programs with AARP, cautions that you should never click on a link directly from social media or from an unsolicited email or text.
if you get an email from, let's say, Amazon or Etsy or something, instead of clicking on that link that they give you, go and type that address into your web browser yourself. That way you're sure that the link isn't malicious. You know, it could be a really good fake.
Scammers are also tampering with gift cards and placing them back on the rack so the card gets drained shortly after a person pays for it at the register. Experts advise pulling your gift card from the middle or back of the rack, then examining it closely to lower your chances of buying one that has been altered. Stokes says authorities are also getting more reports of people receiving a scam text message, purportedly from FedEx, UPS, or the Postal Service, saying there's a problem with your shipment and giving you a link she says you should never click.
Quite often what they're trying to do there is capture your keying on your keyboard, capturing your logins, your passwords, your user account names, and all of that is intended to steal your money right from your accounts.
Scammers like to target people who get regular income from the government, so veterans and those receiving disability payments should be especially wary. For more information, check out Stokes' appearance on the AARP podcast In Clear Terms or call the Fraud Watch helpline, which is 877-908-3360. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Montana is asking federal regulators to cut waterway protections that guard against mine pollution. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Montana Board of Environmental Review is asking federal regulators to invalidate a water quality standard aimed at reducing pollution flowing into Montana from Canadian coal mines. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
In a letter to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the governor-appointed Board of Environmental Review is once again claiming the Lake Coconusa selenium standard is invalid. The pollution standard sets rules for how much selenium is acceptable in the lake. The toxin is known to harm fish reproduction. State Environmental Board officials earlier this year voted to overturn the current rule, saying it didn't follow federal standards. However, the Montana Department of Environmental Quality and the EPA have kept it in place, having previously approved the pollution standard. DEQ said the board doesn't have the power to invalidate the rule and that its claims don't merit review by the agency or the EPA. The EPA said in a statement to MTPR it's reviewing the board's letter. Teck Resources, which owns the Canadian coal mines that are the source of selenium pollution, and Lincoln County commissioners have pushed the Board of Environmental Review for over a year to invalidate the standard. This comes as tribes from Montana, Idaho, and British Columbia push for International Joint Commission involvement under the U.S.-Canada Boundary Waters Treaty to stop pollution from the mines. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The Watersmeet Township School District in Michigan's Upper Peninsula is bringing Ojibwe language and culture into the classroom. WXPR's Aaron Gottsacker spoke with school leaders about the changes and what they mean for the school's majority Native population.
When Alina Shively was a student in Watersmeet, her Ojibwe heritage was largely ignored in the public schools.
You know, it was actually kind of unheard of for any of our language or culture to be acknowledged on a daily basis. I mean, everybody knew we were Native kids and, you know, where we lived in town and where we were from, but it was never really embraced.
But this year, that's changing. The school district is working with a consultant for Native American best practices to better include its Indigenous students, who represent nearly 80% of the school's student body.
We just want to make sure that everyone feels welcome and appreciated at the Watersmeet Township School District.
That's George Peterson III, the district superintendent. He says some of the changes the school is implementing are small, like including Ojibwe greetings and daily announcements.
Every morning we've added to our morning announcements, Bajou, which means hello, instead of good morning. You know, she'll say Bajou, good morning, and then when she closes, she says Magwitch, which is Native American for thank you.
Teachers are also making a concerted effort to include Ojibwe language and history in their lessons.
It's pretty eye-opening for everyone to see what that culture has gone through and the way they were treated. It's pretty sad, really. But we want to help them get through that, and by helping them do that, we have to teach them about that and and move on from there.
For Alina Shively, who's now the historic preservation officer for the Lac Vida Zaire tribe and a mother of three, these small changes represent a monumental shift from the time her parents attended an American Indian boarding school.
You know, education hasn't been a fun experience in my family history, and I can say that that is really changing for my kids and all of our kids.
That was Aaron Gottsacker reporting, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A decade after the tragic mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, advocates for stronger U.S. gun control laws continue to make their case for an assault weapons ban. Edwin J. Vieira has that story.
On the 10-year anniversary of the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, a local organization is still working to see a national assault weapons ban. Newtown Action Alliance, founded briefly after the Sandy Hook shooting, has been active in getting Connecticut's assault weapons ban passed. The group has also spoken with congressional officials about a national ban. David Stowe, with the alliance, describes where the U.S. is with assault weapons in the 10 years since the shooting. In his words, it's insane that people can be armed with weapons made for war.
Where we are now, I would say, I think we wake up every day and more Americans are horrified by, one, about the fact that people can own those weapons, and two, that we actually have not done anything to stop them. There were some small little pieces in the Safer Communities Act that passed this summer.
In the bipartisan Safer Communities Act, background checks were expanded for people under 21, and federal firearms restrictions were extended to include people convicted of domestic violence misdemeanors against dating partners. Stowe feels that, in the current lame duck Congress, a ban would not make it through the filibuster process, but he thinks there should at least be a vote to demonstrate where individual lawmakers stand on an assault weapons ban. One priority for Stowe is to see a shift in the tone of the conversation about assault weapons. He feels people could do a better job of listening to one another when talking about gun safety regulations.
You have to look at the root causes of gun violence, and there's a number of them. One is the proliferation of guns in our country and how easy it is to get guns. So we absolutely need to address that with legislative approach.
He adds having safe storage laws and making sure people with mental illness don't have gun access would help as well. And he points out that mental health services must have funding in order to help more people. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, Connecticut News Service.
Confusion over food labels creates unnecessary waste and pollution. ReFed is a food waste nonprofit that is pushing for new rules to standardize the dates that show up on food packaging. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Sell by, use by, best before. Lots of phrases appear on food labels, and it's often unclear what they mean.
People think that the dates on food are telling them to throw the food out.
Dana Gunders directs ReFed, a nonprofit dedicated to reducing food waste. She says that in many cases, companies actually use date labels to indicate when a product is at its very best.
They're really trying to guarantee when their brand is at its top quality, when it's freshest, but not that if you eat the product after that date, you'll get sick or it's going to go bad.
She says this misunderstanding leads to a lot of waste, which costs money and contributes to global warming. It means more food is grown, transported, and refrigerated than needed, which creates carbon pollution. And when food rots in a landfill, it releases methane, a potent global warming gas. So Gunders' group is pushing for passage of a federal bill to regulate date labeling. It would establish one standard phrase to indicate when food is at its highest quality, and another to identify the date after which safety is a concern. She says making this distinction clear could prevent confusion and help limit global warming pollution. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Here at KABU, we are very lucky to have our own news poet. His name is Dan Raphael, and tonight he has questions about just how good most good news is.
Good news! Last month's inflation was only 7%, down from October's 7.6%, so the next rise in interest rates won't be as high as threatened. Fauci said we won't need a fifth COVID booster this year. In 2022, it didn't take much to be good news, and good news seldom went that far. The last new word of the year is triple-demic. Sunima left the Democratic Party she was never part of, redefining independent as paid lobbyist. Mayor Ted stepped up the rousting of homeless camps for winter and to improve everyone's holidays by making the homeless less visible. It is good news that Governor Brown commuted the death sentences of all 17 on Oregon's former death row. And once again, it's Christmas for the Department of War, getting more than they asked for, with the Republicans ensuring that money must be taken from everyone else. 2023 doesn't sound that good to me. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 14th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and myself, Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Catherine Carley, Mike Moen, Edwin J. Vieira, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, so now is a great time to get involved. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. Have a great night.